The question we're considering today, how will people remember you? You see that at the top of the handout there, and that's where we'll be spending our time. How will people actually remember you? I guess for many it will be by what you achieve in this world, the captain of the team, the head of the firm. Perhaps what we really care about, the workaholic, the family man, the diet, whatever it is. She was the life and soul of the party. We know how easy it is, don't we, to become a sort of stereotype in people's minds, what we stand for, perhaps. I gather the newspapers write obituaries long before the person dies. The Queen's obituary gets attention every week by journalists. I guess if your obituary was in the hands of some local hack, what would they conclude about you, having looked into your life? What would they turn up? What would they uncover? I guess if a journalist really was given that particular job, let's imagine the rather morbid scene of you having died and sort of family looking back now on the life. I mean, how would they find out what really made you tick? They'd use all their normal tactics, wouldn't they? They'd want to build up a picture of your life. They'd see how you spent your time and your energy and your resources. They'd go to your family, to your friends. They'd perhaps go back to your colleagues if they could find them. And they'd ask them what sort of things you would really talk about, what sort of things you care about. As you come into the office, you're the person who's always going on about whatever it is. That would be the sort of thing that they would be interested to find out about. And I guess because this little local journalist really wanted to make a name for themselves, they try to find out the sort of the big idea, the single thing that made you tick. And so they'd probably dig up your financial records, they'd go onto social media, they'd perhaps even hire a private investigator. And down in the end, it would come down to a single idea. The church that Tom was mentioning just now, St. Nick's Church, I know many of you are familiar with, where Tom and I both work on Sundays and through the week as well. There's a plaque in the middle of this sort of ancient old Christopher Wren building, and it simply has this man's name, Anthony, I think his name is, and it just says, Anthony, he stood by St. Nicholas Cole Abbey. And that's how he's being remembered. I think that's a rather miserable way to be remembered, really, isn't it? You've got a picture of a flat-capped man sort of standing, come rain or shine, by this old ancient building. Stood by St. Nicholas Cole Abbey. What about you? What will you be remembered for? Boris Johnson. What's it going to be after last night? Who knows? The man with nine lives. You'll have your own opinion. Definitely the man with the mop of hair. What about Theresa May? She'll be the sort of the person that failed Brexit. Cameron will be remembered for whatever he'll be remembered for. Jimmy Savile, I guess up until about 5-10 years ago, Jimmy Savile, before everything was sort of uncovered, he would have been remembered as a man of real compassion and great charitable works, until suddenly everything was uncovered, and he will always and only be remembered as an abuser now. What about you? Well, as we read through this section, Paul shows us what he really cares about. And he wants it to be sort of infectious, in the first instance, to the Philippian readers, and by implication to all of us as Christian readers today. He wants his mindset to be inculcated by us, adopted, and made our own. Look at verse 12. This is what he cares about. End of verse 12, the advance of the gospel. End of verse 14. People have become more bold to speak about the gospel. End of verse 18. Only that in every way Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. He's saying, this is what I care about. Be somebody who cares about this too. Be remembered for this fact, this ambition, this hope. Paul wants people to come to know Jesus Christ as the gospel is explained, as the word is taught. And he wants us to understand that whatever happens, good or bad, the gospel goes out, the word is spoken. Interestingly, if you've been with us when we started Philippians, I mean, you'll know that Philippians was a letter written to a church going really well. It wasn't written to a church to correct an error. It was written to a church to encourage them. They were going well, keep going well. Turn with me, flick over the page right to the end. Chapter 4, verse 9. Paul says, to the church going well, what you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. And so this passage today sets the overarching agenda for what Paul cares about and for what should be modeled. He's passionate about the gospel going out. And the passage makes the point brilliantly because, of course, Paul holds on to the fact that the gospel goes out even through bad experiences, even through pretty major setbacks, trouble from secular authorities. Again, if you were with us in the first time, he's in prison. He is under duress. But also, bit of a shock, he's also having trouble from within the church. So he's got trouble from outside, secular authorities sort of breathing down his neck, so to speak. Also, people within the church. We're going to have to think carefully about what that means. Fellow Christians maligning him. What does Paul do about these situations? Well, you might think, I mean, those are two pretty serious things, aren't they? People from outside the church giving him a hard time, people inside the church giving him a hard time. You might think he appealed to people like the Philippian Christians going really well to come and help, to come and pray, to get on his side, but not a bit of it. Instead, he's just passionate about the one thing that he's passionate about, the gospel going out. That's what really matters. I think what Paul is doing here is showing the Philippians that when your mind is set on Jesus and not on things of this world, the one thing that you will increasingly see in this world, whatever happens, is that Jesus is made known. Nothing can stop that. If that is your single ambition, if that's the thing you stand for, nothing can get in the way. So let's look at Paul's situation in a bit more detail and see how this has played out. Trouble from outside the church. Verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Paul, under house arrest in Rome. That means he would have been confined to his house. That means probably facing the death penalty. Certainly, as you read on through the letter, that's the idea that we get, that he is facing death in the near future. Roman guards would have been stationed at his house. He perhaps would have been chained to them. Some freedom, nevertheless, to receive guests. Some freedom to write letters, clearly, as he is doing. Does Paul see this as a setback? Not at all. Why? Why does he not care about the fact that he's under arrest with guards potentially chained to him? Because what he cares most about is continuing to happen. Verse 13, so that it, he's referring to the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard. Paul wants the Philippians to share in this incredible achievement. The gospel has been made known to the imperial guard. Now, commentators estimate that there were probably 9,000 Roman soldiers stationed in Rome at this time. It's an estimate. We don't know for sure. But of course, there are lots of historical records that can be appealed to. Rome was the capital of the world at the time. There would have been a sizable Roman contingent there. 9,000 strong, even if it was a tenth of that, 900. This is remarkable. Paul says the whole imperial guard now know the gospel. Let me tell you about the success I've had. It's a wonderful sort of way, isn't it, of talking about it all. Look again at verse 13. The whole imperial guard and all the rest. Okay, it doesn't just stop there. It's not just the 9,000. It's all their friends and family and everyone they know too. I mean, I guess the imperial guard would have been well-connected people. They would have had a lot of influence. Their families would have walked around and interacted with the Senate. Perhaps chatted in the streets about the gospel. Lots of people, as a result of these 9,000 or so coming to hear the gospel, would have heard about the gospel too. Now, it doesn't mean they were all converted. Paul doesn't say that. Paul says they've heard it. The gospel has been made known. It would have been controversial. The chat was obviously contagious. I mean, just put yourself for a moment in the shoes, or perhaps I should say sandals, of one of the guards who would have been chained or stationed at Paul's house. They probably would have been in pairs, perhaps four-hour shifts. Can you imagine what it must have been like? Paul trying out his gospel outline again as he sort of goes through. Hey, chap, come over here. Let me just run this past you. Imagine how many times they must have heard that letter written to the Philippians or the Ephesians. Now, Paul is clearly passionate about getting the gospel out, clearly passionate about making sure the gospel is known. And look here, Paul wants us all to know, verse 12, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. See how he wants his readers to care most about what he cares most about. I mean, there's no doubt that this sort of setback can have a great effect on others. Just look ahead to verse 14. Can create confidence, boldness to speak the word. As other people receive a knock, so the knock-on effect can be very positive to those looking in. Verse 14, most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment. That is strange, isn't it? And yet that is true anecdotally, and I'm sure perhaps from your personal experience, as we see other people taking the hit, so we are encouraged, emboldened to get on and be bold ourselves. Many of you will know one of my favorite missionaries in recent times is Jim Elliot. Amazing example of a man who in the 1960s gave up everything and went to try to reach the lost people of the Amazon called the Orca. He didn't actually get a chance to speak to the Orca people directly because the first bit of contact he had, he and his fellow missionaries were killed with spears. But the effect it had, this is what I want to home on just now, the effect that that sacrifice had on others was huge. Apparently, as a result, he went to Wheaton University in Illinois, and as a result, lots of people from the university then sort of picked up the mantle and carried on and thought, right, well, you know, Jim and all his mates are dead, but we'll carry on, we'll do this work. You know, he's inspired us to get on and do that. Jim's father apparently went back and found the man who had executed his son and forgave him and explained the gospel to him. Numbers of the tribe, including that man in the end, were converted. This is what that man who killed Jim said. I have killed 12 people with my spear, but I did that when my heart was black. Now Jesus' blood has washed my heart clean. It's wonderful, isn't it? But the point here is that Christians, emboldened by other Christians' sacrifice. I remember when I was doing a proper job before church work. I was doing a job not dissimilar to some of the jobs that you guys are doing for 10 years. And it was during the time, I think it was in 99, so just before the millennium, we heard about on the news the terrible Columbine shooting. 15 children shot dead by two gunmen in Columbine High School. And stories were circulated at the time that hit the front pages about how the gunmen went round asking if people were Christians or not. And as these children stared down the barrel of these semi-automatic guns, they paid the ultimate price as they answered truthfully, and many did. So the accounts went. I remember that had a huge effect on me. I just thought, wow, you know, here I am in the office sort of being slighted or being shy, and here are kids actually prepared to pay the ultimate price. This is amazing. That had an emboldening effect on me at the time. It's often been said, hasn't it, that the blood of the martyrs is the seedbed of the saints. And so what about you? I mean, what do you really care about? What will you be remembered for? For Paul, trouble from the outside. Well, it's just another opportunity. It's business as usual. Let's talk about Jesus. These are the circumstances that the Lord has put me in. I'm going to make the main thing today. I talk about Jesus. That's what Paul did. The well-known evangelist John Chapman, some of you will have heard of. He's written great books. He's gone to be in glory, promoted 5 or 6 years ago now. He was so helpful in just encouraging Christians, whatever situation we find ourselves in, to make the most of every conversation. He used to say, every time we get into a conversation is a potential conversation that could lead to the gospel. It doesn't mean that every opportunity should lead to that gospel opportunity, but we should be thinking creatively, passionately about the possibility of every conversation leading to a gospel opportunity. That's the mindset that the Christian should have. That's the Philippian mindset that Paul wants us to have. So, that's trouble from without. What about trouble from within? This is a little bit more particular and worth just homing in on. Trouble from inside the church. Slightly strange. Verse 15. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. the latter, do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to affect me in my imprisonment. As you can see, I've called this point trouble from inside the church, because it would appear that some of the trouble is coming from Christians in perhaps the wider church. I don't think particularly the Philippian Christians. Paul writes to talk about other Christians giving him a hard time. And what Paul is doing here is talking about the motives for teaching the gospel. Here are Christians who perhaps we're left to speculate a little bit, but I think we can speculate in line with what the text says. I'll try and do a little bit of that now. You can be the judge of whether this is right or not. These are Christians who seem to have somehow found themselves potentially in the shadow of the Apostle Paul, and they don't like their lack of attention. There they were, faithfully plugging away at their work of teaching the gospel, and along comes Paul, and suddenly Paul, he's the one getting all the attention. He's the one attracting all the headlines. And Rome is buzzing. We know that. Paul has told us. Buzzing from chat about the gospel, some positive, some negative. But the point is, they've heard it all from Paul and not from them. They could be thinking. Now Paul is in prison, and you can imagine some of these Christians in the wider context saying things like, well, that man Paul, he was always a bit of a handful, you know. Always sort of managed to rub people up the wrong way a little bit. He had it coming, just didn't know when to stop. Not surprising he's in prison. Not surprising. And I think we can probably relate to that sort of sense of feeling a bit undervalued, not appreciated perhaps in our efforts or our endeavors. And it's only a small step from there to start saying things like, well, didn't you know I've been plugging away at what I've been doing for years? Don't see me in prison, do you? And then it's only another small step to saying something that might cause difficulty for your Christian brother. When you think he's gone about it all the wrong way. I mean, you don't have to be so bold, do you? I mean, come on. He constantly said things which just wound people up. But the amazing thing is, whether I'm right to speculate in that direction or not, the amazing thing is when you have a mindset like Paul, whatever it was that was causing this rivalry, you're not going to be worried in the slightest about other people getting more attention than you. In fact, you can even go so far as to thank and praise God for what others have done, even if they're bad-mouthing you as they do it. So where does that leave Paul? Well, you'll see the third and final point there. All that matters is that Christ is proclaimed. Verse 18. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Well, I think this is, you know, as we sort of draw threads together and land in this section, I mean, this really is the challenge, that Christ is proclaimed, Jesus made known. It's a relatively straightforward proposition, really, isn't it? It's something that we all understand. It's something that we can all relate to. This is Paul's mindset, and he wants this ambition, this mindset, to be, as I said at the beginning, inculcated, adopted by the Philippian Christians, and by implication, by us today, as we read this letter. This is what makes him happy. This is what drives him in his life. And it makes so much sense, because just to stop for a second and take stock of all those potential things that you might end up being remembered for. I mean, in reality, all of those things will fade so very quickly, won't they? But actually, think about what ambition can you have that can't ever be ruined? It's the question I put down at the bottom there in the conclusion. What ambition can you have that can't ever be ruined? You see, for Paul, Jesus has become not just another competing care in his life. You know, my name is Paul, I care about A and B and C, and yes, I care about Jesus too. It's not that. Jesus is the overarching care, the overarching ambition through everything else, despite everything else. And through our passage today, Paul is describing what it means to have a life with Jesus as our primary concern. He can't think of anything better to do with his life. He can't think of anything better to explain to the Philippians, to set their minds on, to make their ambition. And so, well, as we start it, so we should end. What do you most care about? It's worth just thinking about that for a moment, isn't it? I mean, how will people actually remember you? What is it that you're sort of passionate about, speak about, talk about? As we diligently go about our day, what actually makes you tick? There's some stuff to think about. I put a few questions at the bottom of the handout, which you may find useful.